Thundergrunt.
Hey guys,
Bob.
Hey Bob.
Hey, and welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of a movie like the script.
Yes.
Yeah. So I want you guys to introduce yourselves and tell me your Twitter handles.
I am Jimmy George. I am a screenwriter and full-time script consultant, and my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
I am Jamie Jack-O-Lantern Nash.
I was trying to think of the Halloween, like,
the Halloween
Simpsons
version.
Yeah, we all need Simpsons.
Jamie Slash. You're Jamie Slash.
Okay.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, I'm the ghost of Jimmy George.
There you go.
Oh, yeah, fine. Yeah.
And I am a screenwriter.
That's it?
What else am I?
Twitter handle,
man.
Oh, Twitter handle. At Jamie_Nash. And I'm juggling. I'm available for birthday parties. And I make balloon animals.
And you wrote a book.
And I wrote a book. Nomad.
Nomad, right.
Now on Amazon.com.
Yes.
Really dating all these episodes that if Nomad's not available one day.
Audiobook is in process. So a couple episodes from now, I'll be able to announce that.
Excellent.
Okay. Awesome. And I'm Bob Rose, and my Halloween name is Blob Rose.
Oh, perfect.
Blob Rose. I guess. That sounds kind of like fat shaming. Whatever.
Yeah. After I said perfect, I was like, that does not come across right.
It's fine. I don't care. And I'm at Thundergrunt Bob on Twitter. And today we're going to talk about a movie that is decidedly not a blockbuster, but it falls into our category of episodes we've done about things that kind of became beloved later.
And it's Halloween.
It's Halloween. So
yeah.
If you're going to complain about that.
This is one of my Halloween go-tos.
This is a movie you can smell the candy corn.
Yes.
That's awful. Yeah. No, but it's definitely, Halloween.
Oh, yeah.
At this point in history, it's a Halloween classic, but.
Is it a trick or is it a treat? Find out on today's episode.
Ready, back,
I'm in radio voice now.
Right. Jamie.
Yes.
In its day, what did it make?
Okay, so this is an interesting one. This movie just beat out Alan Quatermain and The Lost City of Gold for the number 124 spot in 1987 with $3,769,000.
Wow.
Movies around it, North Shore, My Demon Lover, American Ninja 2, Hot Pursuit, bestseller, The Color Purple reissue. At first, I was like, The Color Purple? What the hell?
Anyway. So, 87 was a great year. You guys, I mean,
but like, that is low.
That's really low.
Because everything, you just said like three different canon films. That's how low this scored at the box office.
Wow. Evil Dead 2 was at 102. And, you know, that's not a movie that
was
built to make tons of money. I don't know the budget of this one. Anybody ever heard that? Because it kind of looks expensive in a weird sort of way. The way it was shot.
The makeup
and stuff.
Effects, even for their time, are incredible.
Yeah, the Town Winston, Square scene? Square. That's expensive.
I would guess $10 million. It looks like a Bill and Ted
Somebody's
budget,
out
right?
there yelling at us.
When they're
22.7 million.
When they're sitting there, and I'm sure it's like a mat or something, but when they're sitting there watching the drive-in from a distance, it's like things that look more expensive than you would think.
Yeah. I don't know. I would just guess around 10 because that's for then. That seems like that. But
I
could be completely off.
Other 1987 movies, which we've hit a few, but Three Men and the Baby was the number one movie of 1987.
Stay tuned for that episode.
That's right. Fatal Attraction, number two. Beverly Hills Cop 2 was number three. Good Morning Vietnam, Moonstruck, The Untouchables. Secret of My Success. I didn't realize it was in the top 10 that year.
Wow, that
number
was,
seven.
That was pretty successful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Reboot. Stakeout, Lethal Weapon.
It's Always Sunny did that.
Lethal Weapon's only number nine.
Wow.
Which is
I can't believe
Boys,
the Secret to My
Lost
Success
Boys anywhere up
is
there?
Higher than Lethal Weapon?
Well, it was it Robert Redford? Is he in that?
Secret Ops,
no, that's legal.
Michael
Eagle
J. Fox.
Michael J. Fox, dude.
Michael J. Fox, yeah.
That's the boom, boom. You know, it's another movie that.
It has the Ferris Bueller song in it. Right. Yeah. I love that movie, actually. That,
I was a fan in 87. No, I don't think I've seen it.
If you watch it today, I recommend watching Secret to My Success and then American Psycho. They are a perfect double feature.
Wow.
Because they are about the same thing, except different genres.
Here's what I maybe there's a reason for this, and not to get on, this isn't what our podcast
no,
is
it's
about
not me. But yeah,
but I have to say this. So Secret of My Success beat out the following movies: Lethal Weapon, Dirty Dancing, and Predator.
Wow,
am I looking at the wrong chart?
I have a connection to this movie.
You're looking at some guy's ranking.
It's not top movies of 87.
Right, right.
It's like, what is going on here? How did Secret of My Success beat out these movies? RoboCop is on here.
It beat out that?
RoboCop. You know what it is? It's just because that was like a hangover of its time or something.
Okay.
And then all those movies with time became, they had legs, whereas like Secret of My Success, it was of its time, period.
Okay. La Bamba, which I remember as being a huge hit.
Right. That's really weird.
My mind is blown here. I don't think I can do the podcast today. I need to go.
You walk out.
I'm walking out.
That's a really weird ranking.
The writer of that movie, Jack Epps Jr., he was the head of...
Which movie?
Of Secret of My Success.
Oh, okay.
The screenwriter of that. Yeah. Jack Epps Jr., he was for a long time the head of screenwriting at USC, and I actually hired him to do notes on several of my scripts.
Oh, wow.
And he's, like, awesome. Yeah.
Okay, awesome.
So I have this weird random... He wrote Top Gun and Dick Tracy and Legal Eagles and a bunch of 80s and early 90s stuff. So, and he's
awesome.
Really awesome
okay.
guy. Yeah, he okay. tore my shit apart.
Is he still around doing stuff?
I don't know. How I got connected with him is Creative Screenwriting Magazine used to do those expos in the early 2000s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they were like Thursday to Sunday, 14 hours a day of screenwriting classes. Yeah. And people would come from all over the world. And that's how I got my education. And he, every year...
From the guy who wrote Secret of My Success.
Oh.
That's hilarious. It didn't help much.
Truth be told,
I like that movie, so whatever.
Yeah,
truth be told, another person that was probably there is probably the writer of today's film, Shane Black.
He was.
I figured this.
I saw him
he
speak at
goes
one of the creative show. Screenwriting yes. expos.
And
that's funny.
Somebody who probably wasn't there was probably Fred Decker, the other screenwriter.
Yeah,
he doesn't seem to
the director of RoboCop 3.
The director of RoboCop 3.
Right.
Steering this back to the Monster Squad.
Monster Squad. But I mean, like, I think I remember like about 10 years ago when I read an article that was posted on like Ain't It Cool that talked about Fred Decker and Shane Black having written Monster Squad.
Mm-hmm.
No, I remember like the reaction was nobody remembered that Shane Black.
Right. It was
because Kiss Kiss Bang Bang blew up.
Right.
And everyone was like, by the way, you know, he wrote Monster Squad. Everyone was like, what? It was like a revelation for a lot of people because I didn't remember that. I didn't know that. So,
Well, as somebody, I kind of mythologized the screenwriting days, especially this was the day of the spec script sale, you know? So Shane Black, of course, he rocketed. He became the spec script guy.
Right.
So wait, Jamie.
Yeah.
This year.
Yes.
He is in 87.
Okay.
Shane Black is in Predator.
Yes.
He wrote Lethal Weapon.
Yes.
And he wrote Monster Squad.
That's right.
And they all came out in 87.
All in 87.
That's called fucking winning, dude.
Dude.
That's winning, man.
Wow. What a year for that guy. Holy shit.
Lethal Weapon wasn't one of his huge spec sales because it was his first. So I think that was like $250,000 or something like that money. It was Last Boy Scout, I think, was the big one.
Okay.
That was like 1.75. And then Long Kiss
Goodnight,
So I think they were the two that really
made
over
Last
million.
Boy Scout before Lethal Weapon, didn't he?
Okay.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't
I
think
remember some
true.
Story like
that. We are really romanticizing his career here.
Shane actually
a bit of a hero.
Yeah.
He kind of went into this weird funk where he wasn't writing. He's done this a couple times, and then I think he came out of it with Last Boy Scout.
Okay.
I think, and then he sold it for 1.75. And then he went in another one later, and then he came out of it with Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and his directing career and stuff
like
that.
Well, that got him Iron Man 3 and exactly. everything. They kind of brought him back. Yeah.
And so the interesting thing about these guys, they had this thing called the, and this is the thing I always remember about them. They had this bungalow of 10 guys, 10 screenwriters or something that would come and go. Some of them lived there. Some of them just hung out. And they were called the Pad of Guys or something.
Okay.
It's the Pad of Guys?
It's the Pad of Guys.
They're like the okay. Mad Men of
and
screenwriting.
Yeah. They all hung out there and they were like all young. They were in their 20s. They knew each other from college. And just some of the names like Ed Solomon hung out there.
Oh. Wow.
And then there are other people like Ethan Wiley and Jay Capp. I wrote these names down. Jim Hertzfeld. And they all hung out there. Fred Decker and Shane Black, of course, as well. But
a fly on the wall.
Yeah. And they all hung out there. And that was kind of the cool screenwriting place. And they'd show each other their scripts. They'd share ideas. They'd play ping pong, you know, whatever. Yeah. All the cool stuff. And they kind of got known. If you Google the Pad of Guys, you can see like a picture of them all in the garage or something. And wow. They kind of became the hot new young screenwriters. and they all knew each other. And so Shane was writing Lethal Weapon. I think he had sold that. And Fred Decker had the idea for Monster Squad. I'm not exactly sure about the writing aspects of it, but I did hear that like he asked Shane to take a crack at it. And then Shane came to do maybe a rewrite or something, but he tried to mimic Fred Decker's style at the time.
Like script style.
Script style.
Right. I want to be specific, not like content.
Yeah. Not, yeah.
Like the way
his
that
writing
he
style.
Writes a script.
That's right. Right. He tried to mimic that.
Because if anyone listening doesn't know, Black is famous for writing his scripts so that the reader actually like gets more entertainment out of them.
Yeah,
right?
He
like,
sort that's... of changed the way... That
people read
well,
scripts.
He's known for changing
known
the way. That's
it.
What we were discussing. Yeah, it was news to me.
Yeah, it's interesting that if you look at Monster Squad, it says that Shane kind of was taking Decker's style that already did that to an extent.
Yeah, and Shane Black sort of famous for being the one to kind of not revolutionize, but make this popular. So it was interesting for me to know that Fred Decker was the one who was initially writing lines like the house is huge, like the house I'm gonna buy when I sell this screenplay.
I remember if the house is huge, it's the kind of house you'd love to have sex in. Right. I remember that specifically being a line.
I have the exact quote: exterior posh Beverly Hills home Twilight, the kind of house that I'll buy if this movie is a huge hit.
None of us got it right. I love that.
Really, I remember a sex quote.
No, that's here too.
Oh,
that's
okay.
Here too.
Okay.
So then it goes: chrome, glass, carved wood, plus an outdoor solarium. A glass structure, like a greenhouse, only there's a big swimming pool inside. This is a really great place to have sex. That's it.
There it is. I wasn't crazy. I remember.
So
he made like the actual script writing popular.
And he started that with his first draft of Monster Squad.
Which Fred Decker might have been responsible for.
And
yes.
there's a quote from him that says, I'm going to do everything I can to entertain you. You and me, we're allies here. I want you on my side, and we're going to have a good time for the next 100-plus pages.
I love that pitch. Yeah. And people write like that all the time now. That's like a normal thing now.
It's pretty normal. I mean, I think William Goldman, if you read some of his scripts, has some touches of it, just not as crazy as maybe it got with Shane Black. Like Shane Black took it to the next level. And most people now scale it back a little bit.
Like
they won't do this. The scary thing is when you see this like in every sentence.
Every single sentence. And I do.
And yeah, and that's that's something you might want to it might look like you're trying too hard.
Yeah.
Where I think a little touch of this in your own voice, I mean you don't have to be saying it's a great place to have sex in if you're writing a kid's movie or something. I think if you do this, then
please
you're,
say that.
Yeah, in Monster Squad, it's the treehouse. It's a great place. He puts that line in every movie. But, you know, do it to your own style, your own taste. And you don't have to do it, obviously. There are other ways to make it.
Also, he's Shane Black, so he could do it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure, like, the Iron Man 3 script could be littered with that stuff and it wouldn't matter.
Oh yeah,
he's Shane Black. He's already got the job and he's of name.
But
so
I would say I think the mark of a professional compared to an amateur is understanding that the narrative itself, the action lines, is its own voice that's gonna work in, you know, together with the story that's unfolding to kind of provide an even greater experience for the reader. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
it's like for instance, like with a comedy, I'll get a comedy script that has like 10 laughs on a page from what's happening. And then if the writer has never been sort of like made aware, like, hey, you can make the action lines funny too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they can be jokes that, you know, enhance what's happening already. So it's sort of like you have the opportunity to like double the laughs, and then the writer will bring back that same scene that has 10 laughs and now it's got 20. And nothing has changed.
Are you saying in the context of like if they're trying to sell that script?
Yeah, they've changed the way that they describe the events going on to be a comedic voice that matches the comedy that's happening.
Right.
And suddenly a scene that read made me laugh 10 times is making me laugh 20 times.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and nothing has changed except the way they describe it. So, it's like a huge, and if you have an action one, you know, there's those, if you read a James Cameron script, you know, he's got the action stacking. It's like a very unique style where he'll have like, you know, each sentence, a paragraph will just sort of like look like a poem on a page. And it's like 1 5-word action line after another for like an entire page of like, you know, Ripley facing down the alien queen. You know, these things read. It's just like this block, you know, with nothing but
descriptive
5-word sentences from top to bottom of a page. So it depends on the tone of your story. But like for Monster Squad, it's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's like perfect. I mean, what better way to make it more fun than to add like fun little asides about Dracula and. Yeah,
absolutely. So, I mean,
totally.
Yeah, it fits.
That's exactly right.
Band-Aid breath.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. The movie certainly has that tongue-in-cheek kind of feel that kind of script would work for. I don't know that necessarily that Long Kiss Goodnight has that, but it still works too.
Right, yeah.
So.
I want to read more Shane Black scripts. I haven't. I've only read Lethal Weapon. And I've never like actually read them. I'd be interested to read The Predator.
Yeah.
Because
the new one, where he is now.
Right. I know we're not talking about it, but like, that was not what I wanted it to be. And I want to see what it originally was supposed to be. And I would love to see also his style now.
Right.
Like the most recent thing now.
Yeah.
Also a script written by Black and Decker.
Right.
Right.
Black and Decker.
Yeah. Yeah. That's why also a little bit why that movie was like, oh. Like I was so amped because of Monster Squad. I was
the pedigree,
the guy that was in Predator and his buddy who he wrote Monster Squad with are gonna make another Predator. You know what I mean? Marry me. You know, like I'm down. And then
there's a podcast called Best Movies Never Made. I think
and
it's a relatively new podcast, but Fred Decker was on it not too long ago. And he goes through his early career. I think he was originally on a Godzilla project
that
didn't get made. And he's been on several, like he was on a Johnny Quest project that never got made. And he talks about those. So it's a really interesting, if you want to check that podcast out, because he's on it and he talks about those past projects.
That's the Johnny Quest one. You've told me about that one.
Yeah, and he also, I think in one of those, I can't remember if it's the Johnny Quest episode or the Godzilla one, but he goes into the whole what Predator was supposed to be. Like, and I think that made it
what
out.
The Predator. Right.
And I think that made it out into a lot of the entertainment news. But if you want to hear his interview about it, it's on.
Okay. Yeah, I'm definitely going to listen to that because I really want to know. But let's talk about Monster Squad.
Let's talk about Secret of My Success. Come on.
You don't think I'll do an episode of Secret of My Success? Totally would.
We're avoiding bashing this movie we love. That's
well, I think, let's just start right on the top. I think the criticism we all have of Monster Squad is structure.
Right.
If we're
looking at it from a screenwriting standpoint.
Right. Because I've always said, I think I've been saying it more in our later episodes, where I think it's understood that I don't feel like a script means that the movie's good or bad. Like, I love movies with bad scripts, so I don't, like, you know, the end product can be.
Right.
It can work.
Yeah, with a lackluster script.
And a great script, the end product doesn't work. It doesn't, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This has structural problems.
I remembered it way more fondly structurally than when you pointed this out, and I was like, nah, there's no way. But
we love it. I think me and Jimmy love it too much, but I see structural problems. Yeah, definitely.
I come to this movie much later than you guys. You probably saw it when you were young and kids.
And every year since. I mean, yeah.
You know, I didn't see this movie till years later. So I didn't see it in the theater.
Oh.
It never got a really good video release or anything. So like in the 90s when people started saying Monster Squad and I was watching, you know, Terry Gilliam movies or something.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'll watch that one day. And then I remember actually buying a bootleg of it because I couldn't get it. I couldn't watch
really?
It anywhere. Yeah, I couldn't find it.
I mean, it was notoriously hard to find.
It was really
for
hard
a long
to find.
Time.
Do you know where I got it from? Errol's Video.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember it specific, the giant box with Monster Squad. That's how I watched as a kid.
I missed the window to get it on video, and then it kind of faded away and nobody brought it back, and they never had a DVD release. And I used to go to these, you know, horror conventions and stuff. And usually the bootlegs I would buy would be like these weird, you know, Korean movies that you couldn't get anywhere else. But I sort of remember getting Monster Squad like in the late 90s.
I definitely remember seeing those at Monster Mania and stuff.
So
totally.
I didn't see it till I was you know, probably in my mid-20s.
Okay.
So it's not
that's
like
interesting. Okay.
Yeah, it's not a movie I saw when I was a little kid. However, by the time I saw it then, I was very interested in this genre movies, and it's a genre I write in all the time, and I'm always constantly trying to sell these, and nobody's really interested. Now, it's like until Stranger Things showed up. But even something like, you know, I wrote that Nickelodeon movie, Santa Hunters, that started more like this. It was like kids saying bad words, and, you know, mm-hmm. it was all the things
kids
I love.
Kids in Danger.
Kids in Danger.
Yeah,
it had
yeah,
true
yeah.
danger. A lot of my movies, I have another one right now I'm about to go out with, and it's Kids in Danger. I tend to do that. Like, so I like this genre, so I did seek it out, and I was interested, and I was like, I have to see it, because everybody says it's this
just
classic.
Just so everyone knows, Jamie's wearing a Goonies shirt, literally,
yeah.
shirt right now.
yeah.
Gee, Jamie, you like yeah. telling stories about Kids in Danger?
Yeah, exactly. And it's also like in novels and stuff. I like this kind of genre.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up on the Hardy Boys and stuff
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Right,
so
right.
It's that kind of thing. I think this was originally pitched by Fred Decker as Our Gang Meets the Monsters. Like that was his mashup idea.
Ah, okay.
What year? Just to refresh everybody. What year is Goonies come out?
Oh, now I'm not positive.
I want to say 85.
I was going to say
Goonies
85.
Is before this, yeah.
Oh, no, it is. I'm just saying. Just
I'll Google
refresher.
It. I'll Google
couple
it.
Years.
It has to be two, three, yeah. four,
I was
going to
say 85 or 84.
Lost Boys is the same year.
I think 85.
Well, I think the assumption is always that he would be pitching it as Goonies with Universal Monsters, but I don't, yeah, I don't
85.
See.
85.
I wouldn't see yeah, Fred yeah. Decker even saying Goonies in the pitch.
No.
Movie. No. I don't think
no.
he viewed it as that.
Not at all.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said, I think I read Little Rascals.
Little Rascals, Our Gang.
Yeah, yep. Our Gang. Okay.
Yeah. Our Gang, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah right.
Yep,
yeah,
that's what he said. That's what, I mean, I don't know how great of a pitch that is. And honestly, I conjure up a whole different thing when I see that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but it's an updated, it's like, what's Our Gang in
yeah.
the 80s? Because they have a clubhouse,
yeah,
I guess.
Totally.
They're kids with a clubhouse.
Right.
I can so. See it, yeah.
Well, I'm sure in 2000, you know, one, whoever pitched Van Helsing was like, it's Monster Squad, but
yeah.
like the Mummy.
with bad CGI.
right. Yeah,
it's
right.
the secret of my success with monsters.
right. So.
So we were talking about structure.
Right. I like that when we establish our relationship with the movie.
I do too.
I love this yeah. movie.
Let's give it some context.
No, I love
how
this
we
movie.
Feel.
Probably too much.
I adore it.
I adore it. So my opinion's coming from there, but also with this show, trying to be objective.
Yeah.
You know, looking
me
at
me too.
Like I said to you, Jamie, I love this movie for the moments mm-hmm. and the characters.
I agree.
But yeah, if I had to look
it's got
at
great ideas.
And I mean, obviously the performances of the, you know, and the makeup, it's just
yeah.
it's so palpably good in so
yeah.
many ways. But Maybe the structure is
but
not
I think
the one I'm going to...
The
yeah.
structure stuff is instructive, though, right?
I think so.
Yeah.
So let's dig in.
So, when I was rewatching it, and again, I came to it late. I love the ideas, and I always wanted to make a movie like this when I watched it the first time, and I loved it.
You just
it.
Hate it because you didn't make it.
I'm mad that I didn't make it. Honestly, it is kind of a bummer because you almost wish you could have... You know, that this idea is taken. It's one of those ones you're
right.
jealous of after
yeah.
it's done. And I think this is one of those movies. But when I rewatched it just last night, or maybe two nights ago, it it definitely, the structure is the slow structure. I'm not even sure. The kids really aren't even aware they're monsters, really. There's no confrontation of monsters till almost the midpoint.
Yeah.
It's almost when Frankenstein shows up.
Frankenstein's.
Yeah. So until then, it's just a kid with a book being interested. And there's really no obstacles or goals. It's just a kid with a book. So it actually, you know, when we talk about story structure, we usually have in a movie like this, which is kind of the arch plot movie, the kind of classic storytelling, usually there would be, and I can almost rewrite this to make it right.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you
can almost, would be an E.T. sighting at the beginning.
Frankenstein would show up earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I totally knew you were going to say. Yeah. That's what I would have said. Right. Yeah.
Frankenstein, right. And Frankenstein's kind of also the gizmo of this movie.
Absolutely.
In some ways.
He's
the good
the
monster.
E.T. He is the E.T.
And think about how early Gizmo shows up in the movie. I mean, not again, I know it's not the same thing, but I also think that would give more time for the Frankenstein relationship. The Frankenstein relationship gets like one quick scene. That's an awesome scene. I love when he looks at the mask and it's the old nostalgic mask.
Yeah.
I love that. But I don't think
it's a great whiteboard thing.
Yeah,
oh, totally.
It's a great
whiteboard. Premise delivery.
The whiteboard stuff in this movie
is excellent.
The
whiteboard.
I literally wrote on the paper, the whiteboard is full.
Whiteboard is full.
It's overflowing.
So full.
But I would, if I was rewriting this movie, I would probably push that part to earlier. I'd give more time with Frankenstein to develop that relationship a little more. So it makes the end even more sad. And it works great. The end
works
great. But
I've always felt like it kind of works off Frankenstein, the original.
It's the lore of what we already know.
I hate this sentence, but he loves little girls. You know what I'm saying? But it's working in the opposite of our expectations.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It doesn't take much time, but we already are like, okay,
yeah,
he loves that little girl. We get it.
It's a great revisionist
of the history of Frankenstein.
Yeah, that whole Frankenstein scene as a kid, I was really into Universal Monsters, and I would read books about him and stuff. But that scene always got under my skin. The whole Frankenstein killing the kid thing always was with me. So to revisit that in this way was really effective as far as it goes. But so my issue with this movie is it's kind of this, it's even worse than in some ways than a slow burn. It's almost like a no burn in some ways.
it's like frustrating because we know what's happening.
We know what's happening.
Yeah.
However, so here's what they do to kind of fix that. They cut it down to 80 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So the midpoint happens at 40 minutes.
It's so weird.
And it has plenty of B-story monster stuff to keep us entertained. And the kids' stuff is fun otherwise. So I just think it would have been a more effective movie to shuffle some things around and stretch it out. But right now, I can almost see why maybe this movie didn't test so well or why it didn't, you know.
I thought you were going to say something else.
Okay.
I would say that maybe the thing that kind of like takes the place of the kids already panicking and knowing Frankenstein and everything is the divorce storyline.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
Which
sort of
that,
out of place, but I like it.
I like it, but it's odd to me that it's there.
It feels like they saw some Spielberg movies and they stuck it in there.
Yeah.
Because the kid isn't even aware of it, really. He's like paying attention to Dracula and that argument's going in the background. So his arc, he doesn't really have an arc related to it or anything. So it's like tacked on.
There's
make
a lot
his relationship
of stuff
with
like
his
that.
Dad special.
Yeah.
Which I don't feel like it needed to be there, but it's hard for me to see the movie without it.
No, I know.
But there's a version without it.
My understanding was that was a Shane Black thing that was put in. The cop and the family and,
he's working too hard and everything.
Yeah,
right?
That was one of the Shane Black elements.
I mean, it adds texture to the world for sure.
It gives the dad a character.
It makes you feel the loss.
He's not just dad.
When he shows up at the house and kills
his
partner.
It's kind of funny, though. I see some people go back when they say that, oh, I watched this movie like 20 years later and it was one of my favorites, but I never realized the touching story between that. And I'm like, I don't know if it's that touching, but you know, whatever your opinion is, I guess works.
It's tacked on.
It feels tacked on to me. I like the addition.
I like it too.
I just think, just like most of this, I think there's great ideas, but I feel like they're not always fully
also,
developed
it's
in this movie.
It's an incohesive story in a way. I wanted to ask you guys if you noticed, because we've been doing this now for 2 years straight, just looking at movies and searching for the lessons.
In ways I never have,
honestly.
And
so like things now start to become noticeable that I never noticed before. Like, there's a go to the classroom scene that feels like it has a theme that it's stating, like, science is real, monsters are not. And, like, there's a teacher arguing with them about the reality of monsters. And it feels like at one point they were like, that's something we should explore. And then they were like, ah, never mind. It's not worth it. Yeah, but they left it.
They left it, but it also, like, it's like the inverse of our classroom scenes we usually talk about.
Right.
It's not stating a theme.
No, it does not.
No, but it's saying, it's literally stating the anti-theme. It's like saying, they're not real. All right, bye.
Yeah, you know? That's true. Like, the classroom scene says the opposite.
Well, yeah. Which I kind of like, because it adds a rebellious factor that the kids the movie is about, just like Goonies, the kids are right and the adults have no clue what's actually going on.
Yeah.
That's what that is.
Yeah.
And I think it works toward
it
that.
Works. It does that job. But that. I just thought it was interesting. I was like,
You know what it does?
It feels like it's trying to do something here.
It feels like, this is what the script, and I hate to say this.
I hate criticizing Monster Squad. Yeah. I hate it.
I hate to say this about Shane Black, who's like one of my idols. But what I feel like is, this is a script by an early writer who's super talented and early, you know, have great ideas.
Both Decker and
absolutely.
And they're super talented, have great ideas, and are just have tons of whiteboard stuff. And they have the thing you can't teach. You know, they have that amazing thing.
The spark. Juice.
But they haven't, they have the instincts for things like, you know, probably need to do something with the parents. Let's make them divorce, but I don't know why, but let's throw that in there.
What are we going
to
do with it now?
Yeah, I feel like that's a
not
thing.
Really anything.
Oh, this whiteboard scene probably needs to say something important thematic about the whole thing. Let's put that in, but I'm not really sure. And then, like, even the German guy at the end, like, it's like this poignant moment. I know monsters, but it's like, I
love that moment.
I love
the moment too.
It's but so like, cinematic.
I've always, even as an adult, I'm like, why did they do that?
It's like,
you know what I mean?
Like,
I want it in there, but I'm also like, man, that is some heavy shit.
It's like imagine
if they put it in the new Jumanji movie.
Right,
that same beat, you'd be like, what?
It wouldn't work.
But on an idea, like from like a guy that's like dealing with universal monsters, saying that line and then showing
his
tattoo.
It works so well. Yeah.
Like,
but then it doesn't really get explored. I mean, we don't even learn his name. Like, I was like trying to find, I was like, when I was doing this breakdown, I was like, oh, I got to make sure I quote the name of the character right. And it's just Scary German Guy on IMDb.
The thing is that the Scary German Guy for me was always the proto old man from Home Alone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's exactly that story.
Yeah.
It's just the old man from Home Alone. He gets that redemptive arc with his son.
Yeah.
And this German guy, you know.
Well, he does help open the void.
He helps kill monsters.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this guy,
I guess that is kind of the redemption arc.
Yeah, he gets his...
He kills some monsters finally.
This guy's kind of fully formed in the beginning to say, see, I'm not too scary, am I? You know,
yeah,
he kind of...
Yeah, they kind of figured
I'm saying
that
is
out.
It didn't... Like, Kevin
we
didn't
got, like,
that
one
himself.
Scene of that scary old
creepy
man.
Guy.
Yeah.
Right,
and
right.
So, would you like some pie?
Upon revisiting it, they were my kind of things I was noticing. Yeah. I was like, man, this is, and it's funny because I hadn't seen it in so long that I didn't remember these things. And the last time I watched it, I was just amazed at all the cool ideas and all the stuff. So when I was watching it this time in a more screenwriting analysis sort of way, I picked this stuff up. So that's what I mean. It's got so many good ideas that you can kind of remember it in the best possible version.
Oh, yeah, your brain.
But then
when
I'm watching, I'm like, oh, wow, we're at minute 42 and they don't even know the kids don't even know there's monsters.
Yeah.
And it's only 80 minutes long.
So just in its own defense, I'll say this. On IMDb, the trivia says the studio made them take 10 to 15 minutes out.
Right.
So
off the back end?
I don't know. It just said out. And that could also be a thing.
In 1987, they didn't make 80-minute movies unless it was a big problem. That was a big red flag.
I don't know what's in those, whatever they cut out, like it ended up leading to like a cult classic, so...
Right, that's like all. Yeah, this movie's already won, so we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, but from an instructive, so it has one of these moments. So like, I think it thinks the end of Act One is somewhere different.
Okay,
I think it thinks on 32 minutes, which isn't too egregious, isn't and like for clarity for people who haven't listened to this show before, we are. Fans of long act ones. We are not sticklers
we're not
for 25%
has to be.
Has to be not at all.
You
in
don't
fact,
need to save the cat every time.
No
not at all.
Yeah.
But with this one, it feels like it doesn't need it all. Mm-hmm. And especially since it's so short.
Mm-hmm.
But at 32 minutes, they're in the clubhouse and they're talking about, they're debating the reality of the threat, but they don't actually know. They're just like, my dad heard somebody call and said he's a werewolf, and then a mummy disappeared, but they never actually saw anything. Mm-hmm. And they're not under any threat.
There's no duress.
There's no threat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so like they gather together and they decide to solve the problem, which technically is your classic lock-in moment. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But since we, the audience, know that not yet, they're not really in danger yet, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. it doesn't...
There's no urgency.
It rings false. Like, yeah. It doesn't feel like we're locked in.
It feels
the
more
movie.
Like a debate still.
It's a debate.
I would say the only reason it works is the enthusiasm and, like, paranoia of the kids.
Yeah.
That's the only reason, like, we probably never noticed it watching.
We never
it.
Noticed
Cause
it.
Because it's like, of course, they're yeah. so excited. They're just ready to go. It doesn't matter if they have evidence or not.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? They're just, like, ready to
rock.
Right, well, right. Yeah.
I think that's an excellent point because when movies feel like they're slow, usually the problem is you're like, this thing hasn't gotten started yet.
Exactly.
I don't know what it's about.
There's no lock-in.
But we
right.
know from the beginning, it's called Monster Squad. The kids love monsters. They're investigating monsters. We know that they're going to be the heroes.
We've already seen Dracula yeah. and his plan being, it's enacting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. Oh, and the B storyline, it's enacting.
Yeah.
So
yeah. You right. could say that's effectively why this might work despite the bad structure.
Yeah,
The underlying thing, the note behind the note is, we don't know what this movie's about when movies are slow, but we do know what this movie's about, so maybe we can just sit back well, and then be enjoying
also,
the
Also, to pull back something yeah. you both said during the Mist episode, where it was like, this is the voice of, what'd you say, this is the voice of the author, not the character. I feel like you could almost argue that here. Mm-hmm. Like, the script tells the audience what's going on, you know, with Dracula and all that. We know what's going on. We know how the kids are. And it's just like, it's kind of just saying the audience knows what's happening.
It's like,
what if the kids also know right now for some reason?
The kids just are going to be involved in this even though monsters aren't banging on their door.
The door, and you'll just kind of accept it. And it works.
And they've proven enough interest in it. Yeah.
It works.
But it felt like...
Only under a microscope, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
And so I was surprised when I saw it. That I didn't expect to agree with you mm-hmm. that there was structural problems. And then I saw this moment. I was like, "Well, as a script consultant, I see this all the time. Yeah. It's like an ineffective lock-in."
But if Frankenstein was already there,
it would be totally different.
Totally different.
Yeah. Where the characters aren't really in danger of the story problem, and then it just kicks into gear, but there's nothing for them to solve yet.
By the way, as somebody who works on these kinds of movies, and when I say these kinds of movies, it's tricky because this is PG-13, and so I'm saying kids movie, but is it exactly?
Tween movie? Yeah. But this is like Twilight in the 80s.
these movies are the ones that usually do have save the cat, rock solid structure.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
these are those movies. So if you
like Goonies.
Like Jumanji, whatever, the new Jumanji. I'm not sure about the old, but it probably does. But these movies have that rock solid by the book construction. And when when you hand this to a broad audience, sometimes it can be off-putting that they're like still asking questions about it, or there's no urgency, or there's no getting.
So that's your like kind
the
of theory
note,
of why
yeah.
it didn't click as
why
much.
Why it didn't click, because they would be used, they would be their classic experience.
He's got all these other great things. Great
I mean,
poster.
It kind of is insane. It does kind of insane to me that this movie doesn't make.
I have no idea why.
The trailer's awesome. The poster's awesome. The idea, the premise, awesome. Yeah. Even if
it
was a crap movie, like, I'm surprised people didn't just go for the marketing alone.
Yeah.
But okay.
It didn't have the Coreys.
I was like six. I don't want to. I have no clue.
No, I'm sure the reason it didn't make money was because somewhere down the chain, it was decided that this movie wasn't going to make money and didn't get pushed as far.
It might be that.
I saw everything and I didn't see it.
Right.
Oh. So
you're the problem.
Yeah. No, I didn't see it in 1987. And that's very telling because I saw everything in 1987. There wasn't a movie I probably missed, especially Secret of My Success. I probably was watching Secret of My Success for the fourth time. And I was like, Monster Squad, Secret of My Success.
High
I'm
on
gonna
the charts.
Go. To
this. Yeah, it's Jamie. He gave
Michael
that
J.
Bump.
Fox,
the
Ferris,
Jamie Nash.
Ferris
bump.
Bueller music. I'm there. I'm
done. But, had Supergirl in it.
Supergirl.
Supergirl's in it.
So, but like, so for, Because maybe there are people who are listening who haven't heard us do the lock-in spiel before. Okay.
Give a little idea of what that is.
Yeah, sure. So the lock-in is something that usually happens at the end of Act One, and it's usually this point of no return for the character. And usually the way I've taken to, and I didn't invent this, but the way I've taken to describing it is you have a hero with a goal, and there's an obstacle in the way of achieving the goal, and there's life or death stakes that'll happen if they don't achieve the goal. So in this case, that would be the heroes have to find the amulet before Dracula, or Dracula will
take over the world. And they have to do it by midnight.
And they have to do it. Usually there's on that Halloween. Sense, that ticking, there's that ticking clock there.
Right. Yeah. So here it's 42, it's 40 it's the, minutes.
Okay. It's 40
what,
minutes.
What moment are you guys pointing to with the 42 minutes?
It's 40 minutes 40 when minutes. When they say, when he looks at the book and says, tomorrow night. Right. So we-
That's
we,
the clock starts.
That the clock starts- right. And
they're on a mission.
It isn't until then that we know that the characters know what the story problem is that needs to be solved.
And they meet Frankenstein right after that scene.
Right after.
Because that's weird.
It's weird. It's weird.
10 minutes.
And then they go to the
and
montage.
Then they now, go,
right, yeah.
Which usually does happen at the beginning of Act Two. There's usually a little montage.
If I may throw one thing in its defense, too, there is the phone call from Dracula.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To the kid, which. That does kind of incite him to know something is going on.
Yes.
Dr. Alucard or whatever. Yeah. Alucard.
Alucard. Yeah.
Yeah, Alucard.
But to what Jamie was saying, we don't know. Like, if this was Back to the Future, Marty wouldn't be traveling to 1955 until minute 40. And
I'm just trying to find the little moments that you could defend some of this stuff.
And by the way, there are plenty of movies that are loose with this lock-in stuff. They're not usually kids' movies that are broad, made summer movies that make $100 million or whatever they made back then, $50 million, $60 million. So that's the part. Actually, a lot of horror movies do this. So when I was watching, I was like, well, maybe this is kind of Fred Decker. He's more of a horror guy. So he's doing the old thing where you push the monster confrontation all the way to the midpoint. Yeah. And you have hauntings going on or slashings going on. But they're really not affecting your main characters until the midpoint.
Well, yeah, we got the werewolf story, and then we got Dracula getting everything set up, and that's
it's great. So, and that it does that. It does one of these classic things, which I love, that makes it like a lot easier to engage, where the hero and the villain have the same goal. This is one of your classic ones where they're both after the exact same thing, and those. I mean, the amulet sort of is a MacGuffin.
It is.
Know?
No, it's totally a MacGuffin.
Absolutely.
It's your classic MacGuffin. This plays like an Avengers movie
I really like the amulet.
Me too, man.
I think
it works really well. Is like the one thing I noticed, structurally speaking, is that oddly enough, out of all the monsters, there's an entire werewolf movie in this movie.
Yeah.
And it's like.
It's a great one, too.
Oh, it's fucking phenomenal. And the whiteboard stuff, the ideas. For the werewolf are incredible.
Yes.
Like the best ever.
With
you know,
the bombs.
Just everything. Yeah. Like just the rules and everything.
Yeah.
But like other monsters don't get that as much.
Gilman could have used a lot more whiteboard.
Yeah, I wonder if there's a draft.
He's the Aquaman
Gilman
of the Super Friends.
Although I do like the idea that he dies from like a fucking gunshot.
Yeah, because
is that? What is
he
doing?
I mean, he's out of the water already.
Yeah, right.
Like.
Yeah. Right, but I was just saying, out of all the monsters, like even Dracula, we kind of accept what he is.
He's a hammy
Whereas the Wolfman,
Skeletor. Yeah.
We're watching the Wolfman's actual story unfold.
Yeah,
right.
So I don't know. It's like that kind of fills
a lot
of that.
And the Wolfman, when he's a man, is trying.
That was
to help.
The hauntings, which is what I'm saying.
Right.
It's the Wolfman's story. Yeah,
I agree. So that's what I mean. Like that's how
the great
I was.
John Grise, by the way.
I was trying to put my head around the structure of this, and that's what I was coming back to that kind of horror movie structure. Where you keep the monster there, but it's all in B story until the midpoint, and then they're confronting. So it's kind of like an adjacent movie. You don't want to have the hero confront Jason in the beginning because they'll just leave, or then the whole thing will be a chase.
Yeah.
So instead, you kind of have this story where weird things are happening, but they could be explained other ways. So it's almost keeps that first half of Act Two almost a debate. Like, is it real?
Yeah.
Isn't it real?
Yeah.
Now,
and that the Wolfman call and everything, isn't that kind of what that's doing?
I think so.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they hear in the clubhouse.
That's what I mean, right? That's my alternative structure to this. I'd still want to tweak it a little bit so that they were more directly involved or saw some things
earlier.
I totally agree with you about the Frankenstein thing. Yeah. Like, bring him in earlier, like they see E.T. or Gizmo at the beginning, mm-hmm. and they know something's up.
Right,
it's just real. You need this.
We're hiding Frankenstein in our treehouse.
Yeah,
there's something going on.
You have to change how Frankenstein gets there.
Yeah, he would just be sent on the mission earlier. That's all it is. Because as soon as they leave the clubhouse, saying, "Are we the Monster Squad or what?" It cuts to Dracula saying to Frankenstein, "I want you to go find those kids."
The balls on us to try to fix Monster Squad.
But it's weird.
It is weird. Like, no, it is.
Because I think it's funny you were saying, like, and then the midpoint happens. Like, I actually think the midpoint happens 4 minutes later.
Which is
when Dracula finds the amulet. Because in the old house. Like, this has one great function of a midpoint. Often a midpoint will show you a false ending, mm-hmm. and it's usually the opposite of what the actual ending will be. And this is a perfect one.
Right.
Dracula finds the amulet and he says, "Soon, evil people." What does he say? He says, "Soon the creatures of the night will rule the world and no one can stop us." And that's like such a great midpoint, like emotional high. Like,
right.
Oh shit, mm-hmm. Dracula's got the amulet. Oh no.
It's kind of like a dark night for the soul.
So it's just funny that the end of Act One is 4 minutes before.
Right.
Like, the kids don't even learn about what's happening until 4 minutes. Because
they don't hear him
before.
Say that.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, that's to me feeling like the instincts are there,
right.
but it's
the
like.
The talent.
They're not clean enough. It's not concrete enough or something. That's
because they were kicking ass with shit like Wolfman got Nards. You know what I mean? Like, the ideas
like,
are
God,
so
who cares,
good.
Man? Who cares about the structure?
Yeah, who cares? Like, that's how I kind of feel in the end. Like,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, it works in spite of all this. But it's very instructive.
For 30 years, I never had a problem with structure.
I didn't even notice it until Jamie said it. I've seen the movie like 50 times.
I know.
I watch it every year.
I know, yeah.
But, yeah.
The whiteboard stuff. That's where I kind of stand on the ideas are so good.
Totally.
And that's the spark. Like you said, that's where those two guys shine unbelievably here.
Yeah.
For this to be someone's first script and it to be that clever, mm-hmm. you know, the cleverness of it. I mean,
it's like we've talked about, like some movies are basically fun and games from fade in to fade out, mm-hmm. like Bill and Ted. This is like that. I mean, the early fun and games happens like, you know, 10 minutes, 15. It's all fun and games with this movie, you know? Yeah.
Let's talk about writing transitions.
So we haven't talked about transitions much on this podcast. We're like 44 episodes in, and I feel like this is a topic we haven't discussed much.
Good one to
Am
bring
I
it
wrong?
Up.
No, you're not wrong. It's funny with transitions, like as a writer, that was one of the things that came much later to me, like to pay attention to that stuff. And now I'm all about transitions. Like, I can't not write a transition from scene to scene in my script.
Yeah.
So I think it's good to be aware of those.
Transitions are kind of what give you the audience a sense of quality, to be honest.
Yeah.
I've learned that as an editor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just hard cutting to everything. There's something that feels cheap.
The number one most common note I make after Make It Harder on an amateur script is needs a stronger transition, except I'm doing that for 100 pages.
Right.
Because most writers that, like you said, Jamie, and for me it was the same way. I actually didn't get good at that until we started making feature films and we started getting to the point where we needed to edit.
Right.
And it wasn't cutting in a way that was interesting or entertaining because I had never been made aware of the fact that, like, it's the writer's job, because that's the big misconception. The transition is not the director's job, it's the writer's job, and then the director, whether they see fit in the moment, decides whether they're going to use your transition or whether they're going to find some more interesting visual
You could maybe fudge it with the editing and the music and the you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you could maybe fudge it, but it's hard. It should be there constructively already.
For instance, I will get most scripts I will get. And when I say most, I would say 7 out of 10 scripts I get from amateurs. It's dissolve to, fade to, cut to, dissolve, like for the entire script. It just goes from one scene to another and there's actually no flow whatsoever from scene to scene, because they haven't been like made aware that this is your job. This is like another fun aspect of the craft.
Okay.
You know, like this is another way to like share your voice. Mm-hmm. Like this is a voice thing. You know what I mean? Like think about Edgar Wright.
I mean, that's what I mean.
But like you remember, I could like quote transitions from his movie off the top of my head.
Scott Pilgrim is a masterpiece of transitions.
That's in the writing.
Yeah.
And so this, I think, is like a great, if somebody has never really approached screenwriting that way, this is a great entry to that, because it's got some of those like some really funny
really
transitions.
Brief. Yeah, give us an example, Jimmy.
Like vampire bat hangs from a tree. Cut to them in the club house saying, "There's only two ways to kill a vampire." The best one, I mean, I think this is my favorite transition of all time, is the dad says, 2,000-year-old dead guys don't just get up and walk away by themselves.
And it cuts
to the mummy just like dragging himself down the street. I mean, it's very literal, but it's hilarious.
No, it's a hard.
Yeah. The werewolf attacks the coroner in the back of the car, and then you hear screaming, and it cuts to them watching the drive-in movie and the lady on the screen screaming.
Yeah.
Sean says, "We're going to find a virgin. It's a piece of cake." And it cuts to Rudy drinking. "Hey, Rudy, you know any virgins?" And he just spits out his drink all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
Dracula, when he says, "Soon the creatures of the night will rule the world, and there is no one to stop us." And it cuts to an alarm clock of a 12-year-old in his bed
getting up.
Yeah, I mean, it's
so
perfect. It's so good. And like, that's writing, mm-hmm. you know, it's writing. And
I could probably make like a list of my 50 favorite transitions from movies I love.
Oh, man.
Like that's how much. Yeah. Like transitions
but
are that important.
It's such an important part of the craft that's like an afterthought.
There's an article. I'm always pitching wordplayer.com. There's an article. It's really long, and I would do a horrible job trying to retell it. But it's about the storyteller cut, they call it. So Terry proposes there's two types of
tell
cuts.
Them what WordPlayer is for anybody.
Yeah, WordPlayer is Terry Rossio's site for and he basically has all these great columns.
He's the guy who wrote the Pirates movies, right?
Pirates movie, Shrek, a bunch of other things.
As good as it gets.
Small Soldiers,
right. Aladdin. So there are all these different columns that are really long and really in-depth. And he has two types of cuts he talks about. And it's less about transitions, but it's almost more about the inspiration behind the transitions, or like the next part of it. The first one's like a storyline cut. And the storyline cut is something like Indiana Jones going, "Truck? What truck?" And then cut to the truck. You know, that's the storyline cut.
Right, right.
It's following the storyline. And the other one
almost
is
a time jump.
Bill Martell calls that the Gilligan.
Okay.
Like Gilligan's Island scenes.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other one is called the storyteller cut. And the storyteller cut is the riskier cut. And that's the storyteller pushing somebody to a spot in the story they want you to go, as opposed to one that the storyline is dictating you to go to. And he goes through a lot of ways to help you figure out transitions to storyteller cuts, because he says they're the more precarious ones.
Okay.
They're harder to
figure
out.
Have to justify them.
You have to justify them.
Yeah.
And I like that.
There's a huge article on that I always remember on wordplayer.com. And instead of trying to explain it, because I'd have to reread it to explain it, I just point you there. It's a really good article along with the other ones. So the storyteller cut, just Google storyteller cut and you'll find it.
Is there any example of Monster Squad of that? Can we think of one?
Monster Squad does jump around storytelling wise I think a lot, especially when it goes to the monsters itself.
I
can't think of the specific instance.
Not
that it's not there.
I was wondering if maybe you had one.
I just can't remember one. I didn't even expect to say this until I was listening to you and I was remembering the storyteller cut. Otherwise I'd have a better answer.
You made a great point when we first started talking about the topic, though. I don't know about you, but like when I'm in the treatment phase or the outline phase, the transition is in the outline. Like it's part of the description of the flow of the story.
So what I've taken to do recently is I try to have opening and closing images in each of my scenes in my outline. So I try to come up, I've tried to force myself to come up with, and sometimes I change them when I'm writing, but I try to force myself to come up with what's that cool opening image. So that implies transitions a lot, because a lot of times I'm you know,
it sort of figures out how to organically make it all flow together. Yeah. Because that's what's most important is like, you'll have one scene and then what you see on the next scene as a person who's not aware of like the craft of editing, like an editor would be like, what am I going to do with this?
I've actually edited people's stuff and then they were like, why doesn't this work? Kind of blaming me. And I was like, well, there's another material. So what do you want to do here? And they're like, oh, wow. They don't have anything.
So as an editor, like you run into this a lot.
I mean, I used to, not now.
Now,
really.
Now he just uses a star wipe.
Yeah. Well, it's most people like, I've edited a few like amateur people's shorts. And the one thing I can say is what I feel like it's kind of conducive to what you're saying is that the scene just ends abruptly. Mm-hmm. And there's like, they literally cut the footage after the last line is said. And then the next scene, it's like, it starts right when the next line is said. So it's like, what are you doing there?
Yeah.
Well, what? How do you go from scene to scene other than cold cut?
And in the writers, in the writing, the patch will be, well, I'll just write a cut to, or I'll write a dissolve to, or I'll write a fade to, and let the people on the set figure out how to make that flow. Mm-hmm. But but just in making that decision to just leave it up to somebody else, it makes your story. It lessens your story.
It can be a visual thing too. It doesn't need
to
be dialogue.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, oh my gosh! Yeah, there's so many strategies.
It could be like the eye becomes the whole.
I failed.
Like, you know what I mean?
In
like shit like that.
Writing a list of strategies.
Right.
I was just gonna use these as an example to start from.
If this movie has structural problems, the transitions give it that false sense of good flow.
Flow. Oh my gosh! Yeah.
Because of those transitions, it kind of saves it.
Oh, yeah. It makes it feel like you're in the hands of somebody who's master at this. Absolutely.
I didn't actually realize that, but that's probably the reason it feels so
polished.
Oh, yeah. But it's not under a microscope.
Yeah, because Fred Decker is great. I mean, I bet you if you look at any Fred Decker movie, he's got transitions that are just as fun like as the Edgar Wright ones from movie to movie.
I
kind
of want to rewatch Night of the Creeps just looking for
transitions.
I bet you
those transitions rock.
I bet they really do.
Yeah. They're probably all as fun as this.
Okay. I think writer-directors probably are really good at writing transitions.
How I learned. I learned from Chris. Yeah. I mean, he leans on the puns, but like there's many ways to do it. But like that, he was the big teacher for that for me. He was like, dude, how am I going to make this work?
It's funny. A lot of times,
it's also a joke.
Yeah.
You're adding in a joke
there
too.
It
can
be
a joke. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
A lot of times that's the one shot that has the jib or something. Or the dolly. You know, you're pulling back from something. So there's other transitional ways to do it as well. But still they need an image to figure it out.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was kind of saying. Like if like the people who I've had bad experiences with, if they just filmed longer, then they could put that fade in there.
Yeah.
They didn't even think about the fade, Jimmy, is what I'm saying.
No, they don't.
I read scripts all day
that don't think about
that. It's just there's nothing there.
And then but here's what's awesome. Once it's pointed out to people,
then
they kick ass.
They kick ass.
It's
they
not
come
a hard
back
thing.
And, yeah, it's not hard at
it's
all.
It's one of the easier things in scripts. But.
I get it back, and I'm like, holy shit, this is like 10 times better just because it flows from scene to scene. The story is exactly the same, but now the transitions are there's artistry there.
Right,
match the artistry of the A to Z story. Yeah.
Right. Well, we're talking about transitions. Let's talk about setups and payoffs.
Transition into setups
and payoffs.
Specifically in dialogue with this
That's
movie.
What you want to talk. Yeah, dialogue.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of movies don't do. They'll do like the rule of threes with dialogue, and they'll do the dialogue callbacks.
Right.
I feel like this one does a lot of setups and payoffs that are specific to the dialogue, like which is like not normal. Like it doesn't rely on visuals. It relies on like.
I think there is visual payoffs though.
Yeah. But specifically, this one, you know, the
name is Horace. I mean, that's a
I mean, that's huge. Yeah.
Fat kid versus.
Yeah, but you take out the mocking of him being called fat kid over and over again.
Well, that's the setup and the payoff, isn't it?
But that's dialogue based.
I guess you're right. Yeah.
That relies on the dialogue.
It relies on what they're saying.
Yeah. Right. Which is not your standard. Your standard is like more like you see something one way and then you see it another way.
Right.
Yeah. That's what I mean. Wolfman got the I told you one way. There's how many ways to kill a werewolf, you know? And there's the debate. And then in the end, you know, I told you there's only
one way to kill a werewolf.
That's a dialogue payoff.
Yeah.
The I taught him how to talk. The bogus setup and payoff. That's a dialogue. You know, I just think it's very instructive. This movie in those dialogue setups and payoffs. It's like it's very unique to this, I feel like.
Well, it's got that youthful questioning, and then it has the answer.
Well, that's a good
What would a kid ask about these monsters, and then it answers what the actual thing is?
The whiteboard.
Mm-hmm. Well, the werewolf thing. I mean, it's like they show, what is it? It's
awesome.
Yeah, you can't kill this fucking thing. This is possible. So, yeah, I never thought of that for being dialogue-based in this movie. But
yeah, I think it leans on the dialogue. Yeah.
It is Shane Black, so like, why is that surprising?
It's not.
Yeah.
But it's just, if we're mining this for instructive, yeah.
Exposition. Techniques.
So this is like heavy-handed in the exposition.
Reading books, prologues.
Right.
Coming up with plans.
Probably if I had to list a second criticism, I probably would have said exposition.
Yeah.
That'd be my second.
Yeah. But it works. Mm-hmm. It works.
Yeah, it doesn't feel painful or anything.
It's got two techniques that are like tropes, but they work really well. The Clubhouse Monster Squad scene where they're giving Rudy the test.
Mm-hmm.
That like motivates the question and answer, and a great technique for exposition is somebody being corrected. Mm-hmm. So like somebody says one thing about the way they think the world of the story is, and then they're wrong, and the people in the know go, "No, it's this way." And then now we in the audience know, okay, in this world, these are the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And that Clubhouse scene is like a perfect way to set up the rules. Okay, in this story, the monsters are going to be killed this way. And instead of just saying that, they found like a clever,
fun way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No worries. The one thing that watching it now in 2019 sort of bugged me was that this monster squad that are, you know, monster experts, they had such a surface level. They had my mother's level of monster. You know what I mean? Like in 2019, they'd have to have a deep dive. It would need the Kevin Smith version.
We have so much more information at our fingertips.
Yeah, they're missing the internet.
Like when the German guy goes, "Look, my reflection." You know, and it's like, yeah, we've seen those movies.
Right.
Anyway, I get it.
Watching it,
remember back in the 80s, it was kind of new to have characters that knew things about pop culture.
Right,
that's why, like,
right.
American Werewolf in London was, like, revolutionary.
Right.
They know about werewolf movies?
Yeah.
Like, it was kind of like people didn't have that information. You had to read specialized magazines.
To your point, and they even mentioned that, you're not going to read those monster magazines anymore.
Right.
The kid who sees the monster's closet.
Yeah.
I love that moment. That's a great whiteboard scene. Yeah. There's a monster in my closet.
Yeah, no, that's
I was going to say,
why
also,
is that monster in her closet?
It doesn't ever explain it.
Because it's a great whiteboard thing, and that's it.
You got to put it in the movie.
How did the mummy get in that house?
Why does it leave after?
It doesn't hurt anybody. I was going to say, though, as far as exposition, the one thing I noticed expositively about this is it's kind of genius because it uses the exact thing you would already think, is that Dracula is giving you all his exposition because all of his lackeys can't speak.
Yeah.
I was like, and we all know they can't speak, so he does have to describe to them.
He tells them the plan. Yeah.
It's like it works perfectly because none of them have like linguistic skills.
Totally motivated.
It's perfect.
That's good.
It's perfect.
And it's just natural and organic.
Right.
To your point, Jamie, about the lack of monster. When I watched this time, last year I showed my 12-year-old nephew this movie.
Okay.
And I was like, I was like so excited. Like, yes. And he was just kind of like shoulder shrug reaction. Mm-hmm. And then when I was watching it this time, I thought exactly what you thought. Like, wait, my 12-year-old nephew has like an Xbox game where he's like a monster hunter and he's killed he's spent like hundreds of hours killing like every monster and gaining all the weapons and knows all this stuff. And he's watching these kids his age who are like, how do you kill a vampire? No wonder he's
We're bombarded
bored.
With it for the past couple of decades. And it's like, it's innate.
He's probably like, we didn't talk about it in depth, but he's probably like, kids are the monsters.
This is real. He's probably like, this is really dumbed down.
Like, my 7-year-old niece knows more about monsters than these do.
Right.
Typically, I think if you were writing this for 2019, you'd only do the things that were different in your movie, not Silver Bullet kills a werewolf.
Well, let me defend this too a little
bit.
Because there is a very specific moment where he gets mad at his father for not taking him to see what is essentially a parody of Jason.
Yeah.
Right.
I think if the monsters were the modern ones, those kids would have been up, because he obviously knew everything about Groundhog
Day. That's true.
He was like, it was called Groundhog Day.
Yeah,
he was an expert about that. To them, these things are like, back then even, they were really old things that these kids didn't have.
That's true.
The exposure they wanted to. So
yeah, they were kind of like not popular, the monsters. It was so weird to think about.
It was hard to get info on this
in
stuff
this
for
Instagram
them.
World where people are selling.
Dude, we could
art.
Watch the Wolfman on my phone right now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think if it was like them versus like Freddy and Jason, they would have already known everything.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
That's true.
Because that's popular and the information's there.
Yeah, that's a good call.
I'm not buying it.
Okay. Okay.
I'm not buying it.
These kids suck.
at their club.
At their club.
But
okay,
the other exposition technique I wanted to talk about was the there's a great trope that works really well, which is the having a character decipher a mysterious message.
Mm-hmm.
And that motivates just literally dumping the exposition right on the audience. I mean, is like in every sci-fi like channel movie and every sci-fi show. Like, think of any Star Trek episode where they go to a planet and then, like, you know, Data shows up and deciphers the message, and now we understand the world that they're on. I mean, but it works because, like, that's his job. He's there to, like, translate for us. So just a great, simple exposition technique that, even though it's heavy-handed as shit, it still works.
Yeah, it's so heavy-handed. It's
oh my gosh,
heavy-handed.
On this date, 100 years.
It's really heavy-handed.
It's super heavy-handed. Yeah.
I think we've almost covered everything, but except for we didn't really talk about the prologue.
I wanted to talk about the
prologue. I think
that is
something we should talk about.
Bit.
Yeah.
Because if you don't show the prologue, imagine this movie.
Well, like, I think everything Jamie said about the structure is even way worse.
That's what I mean.
It's so important that it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise you don't even know what the hell like you would be scared of happening to them.
No.
You know, or what they're trying to do.
Also, that Van Helsing thumbs up would be not the greatest thing in history. Because that's like my favorite thing ever.
My favorite GIF.
Right. Right. Yeah, yeah.
The thumbs up.
The thumbs up. But you like, where else would you put that? It has to be there. But if it wasn't there, imagine the slog to get to Frankenstein.
God. Oh, my gosh.
It would just be a guessing game of, are we just watching a bunch of kids know nothing? Mm-hmm. And then Dracula would kind of show up.
Because I know a lot of people are not into prologues. And like they'll be like, I don't think that movies should have prologues. This isn't a book. This is a movie. Mm-hmm. You know,
By the way, books are notorious. Like editors and stuff hate prologues.
So it's one of these things where it's like, sometimes it's absolutely like, this movie does not work without it, you know, and it does this great. It shows us like what the end looks like if they fail, which is another great thing. I mean, they do that awesome in the beginning of Mission Impossible. You know, we talked about in the Mission Impossible podcast how we see what it looks like in Fallout if Ethan fails. We see it right at the beginning
of
the movie,
right.
And they made it up. This one, it shows us like, fuck, if this is what they have to do, and if they fail, this is what it looks like. So when they're failing, in the end, we have some visual context to like what
happen.
It like makes you feel a deeper sense of stakes because
we
saw it.
It also introduces the MacGuffin, the villain.
Yeah, it's a setup.
It's like the most important thing in the movie.
It really, Like I don't think anyone would argue that, right? Yeah. We're not arguing that somebody.
No,
would say,
but I hear a lot of arguments against using prologues. Like that's like a common thing. I think like. Cut the prologue out of your story. Start get us in.
I think
there
later. This prologue this prologue serves as a bookend as well. I think the problem you might get with a prologue is if it's not a bookend. Like like what if it was a prologue about the kids coming to the new school? Like that's the bad prologue or something, you know.
Yeah.
That's the version like a year ago, here's what happened with the kids or
here's
something.
Here's how they
moved here. Yeah. Like that's the bad prologue, and that's what whenever you hear these things, don't use flashback, don't use prologues. They usually have, the reason is because people use them very poorly. Mm-hmm. Like they don't know where to start their story, so they start it everywhere and they put a prologue and they do a thing and then it's like, no, just get to your story. You don't have to start that.
But this is the story. Yeah,
this is
this
the bookend.
Story.
This is a bookend that's I think needed.
It's the 100-year bookend.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, without it, the movie would feel incomplete.
I think there's something about it, too, that these are monsters that come to the suburbs, that it suggests that there might be a good little, you can do the tail end of the first movie, the original movie, which was back in the, you know, in the olden days and Van Helsing and stuff
like
that.
It's like a passing of the baton.
Yeah,
from the old
to the new
in 1987.
Yeah. Well, kind of the movie is like, what if a bunch of kids were Van Helsing?
Right.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're just showing that first one.
Yeah.
And apparently in the original script, I did read this, the original script, this whole opening scene was way bigger.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Like armies of the dead.
Wow.
Castles, like a Braveheart level fight scene.
Okay.
And they were like, oh, we can't afford that. It's going to happen in a basement. So, yeah.
With like three skeletons.
Right. Yeah. And so it changed drastically. But originally,
still awesome.
Originally, it was like a whole epic fight. Man. But yeah, it changed. So, but yeah, without it, I think this movie would feel completely not finished.
Yeah.
Or like if somebody everyone would just be like, yeah, the third act of Monster Squad's all right. You know what I mean? Like it's just
a great example of a prologue that like absolutely like is needs to be there, and mm-hmm. and without it,
it's without yeah
yeah it, the movie doesn't work. Yeah.
What'd you guys learn?
Ooh.
From Monster Squad under a microscope.
Personally, I learned that the structure is not strong, which
I think we all learned that one.
I mean, I can't imagine I've seen this movie less than 50 times.
Right, same.
For me to not ever notice that is really surprising, and it just shows how blinded I am by my absolute adoration for it.
Right.
Yeah, and I think along those lines, I think I can kind of learn that doing things, there are ways if your structure isn't good, the feeling that you know what the story's about and you're in this trajectory toward the end can sometimes overcome it as well.
Yeah.
You know, so there.
I mean, it has.
Yeah.
It pretty much has.
It's doing even though the structure, it's doing other things that it doesn't have to worry about the rock solid structure, and it's keeping you moving forward. So I think that's.
I mean, once you hit that montage, does it matter? Does anything matter?
Yeah.
Once that montage happens, you're like, I'm sold.
I can hear the music right now.
I learned that Secret of My Success was way more successful than I ever
thought. Yeah, holy shit.
What is the secret?
Tell us the secret.
Tell us.
Right. All right. I just want to say also that if Fred Decker or Shane Black ever hears this, I love you guys.
Yeah.
Please don't take the criticisms hard.
I have a few notes, Fred.
we always forget to say this. If you have any comments, questions, we have an email address that has received emails from two people in the entire 2 years. So it's
on fire.
Yeah. writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com. Yeah, Shane Black. He asked us to do this episode.
You can also just tweet us.
Yeah, you can tweet us.
Tweet us. That drives more traffic, I guess. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You do what you use.
You do. Thank you for listening. We appreciate it. Oh, and this is the Halloween episode, isn't it? Sort of.
This is the closest to Halloween episode. That's why we chose Monster Squad, yeah.
Awesome. Happy Halloween,
Happy
everybody.
Halloween.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.
Thanks, guys.
You've just listened to Writer's Blockbusters, a screenwriting podcast featuring two professionals and another guy. Available only on Thundergrunt.